Well, last evening I suggested that perhaps we could read Genesis so as to see that the blessing of Israel for all the families of the earth is the gift of laughing with God, wrestling with God, and giving thanks. And then I made this giving thanks into an ambiguous thing, and we'll spend the rest of the time probing that ambiguity and that gesture and all that it might mean in the way of giving thanks and handing things over to God. But I must start with a confession, and the confession begins with some words from someone else. I once heard Father Gerard Sloyan, an eminent New Testament scholar from Catholic University in Washington, D.C., who was in Valparaiso to give a talk, explain how it is that Catholics can tell the difference between all the different Protestant groups. How do you distinguish among all these people? And he said it's very simple. You just watch what happens when one of them or any number of them fall down a flight of stairs. And you see how they respond at the bottom. And the Presbyterian will say, "Thank God that's over." The Methodist will say, "Boy, I really must do that better next time." But he left us to figure out what the Lutheran would say. And some of my colleagues thought that perhaps the Lutheran would say, "I'm sorry." But only some Lutherans would say that, and they may, in fact, be some form of pseudo-Lutheran. I've decided that a true Lutheran would say, "What does this mean?" And the answer would be, it means at least two things, and those things would not agree. And so we would have a paradox. But I was having an unfortunately non-paradoxical moment, an un-Lutheran moment, when I developed my theme titles a year ago. And I do mean the rest of the way, though I have titled these things "Into God's Hands," "Into the Hands of Sinners," and then back again into God's hands. The truth is, you can't tell the difference. And so I mean to be talking about those two things simultaneously. Being handed over or betrayed into the hands of sinners, and being handed over, offered up in sacrifice, it's really all the same thing. It's really all a form of yada, being handed over. So I got together with my former student and now colleague, whom I'm sure at least a few of you know, a man named John Nordling, teaches classics now at Valpo, and we tried to come up with an equivalent to simul justus et peccator for this paradox. And so the title for today that isn't printed in the program is "Simul traditus et sacrificatus," at the same time betrayed and sacrificed. I begin with an obvious point from Mark 14. Jesus came a third time and said to the disciples, "Are you still sleeping and taking your rest? Enough. The hour has come. The Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Get up, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand." And immediately, who arrives but the hander over, the betrayer? Ironically enough, Judas, that Hellenized form of Judah. And he plays his role, his ancient role, the same one he played on the day that he betrayed Joseph into the hands of slavers. This Judah plays a role as a hander over, without which, it would seem, the redemptive plot could not unfold. He saves our life by selling his friend into the death machine, all with one sentence. He is Judah. But another reason to bring up this story has to do with its relationship to the lifting up of hands, which has gone on a little earlier in the evening, back there in that rented room at the meal. There Jesus had spoken as well of being handed over, and then he had blessed the bread and given thanks for the bread and for the wine in that gesture of receiving as well as offering up. And then he called that thing, that meal that he offered up, his body and his blood, to be for food and for drink for his disciples. And Mark says, all of them drank from the cup. Now this means in the world of ancient Jews, who did not drink the blood of any creature, indeed for the Torah forbids that, for as it says in Leviticus, the life of a creature is in its blood, and that belongs to God. And you may share as food all the other parts of the animal, but that you may not have, that belongs to God, and that you return. And so Jews do not eat blood. But these Jews on that night all drank of that cup, this blood, this life of the one betrayed. So the life that they took into themselves that night was in that moment a life worth about 12 hours. That is, they partook of a life that would later in the story, of course, as we learn in Mark 16, 1 to 8, would be off again going ahead of them somewhere in Galilee, beyond what lie immediately ahead. But first that life had to go through Gethsemane and the heavy, aggrieved praying on the ground of that garden. And then through the betrayal, the handing over itself, and the trials, and the beating, and the crucifixion, and the unfathomable abandonment out of which the handed over one cried, my God, why you too? The shape of life formed by the Eucharist is the life that's handed over. We too are betrayed into the hands of sinners. That is simply who we are in this habitus of the Eucharist. It sounds like such a commonplace, and we say, why, of course, that's who we are. But this does not sell well. The free market has a little place for an invitation to come and suffer, come and experience with us betrayal, suffering, death, being offered up. I'll quit picking on the nice church, but you know, those things just aren't nice. Yes, we drink a cup of salvation. We taste freedom. But we become a community handed over when we eat and drink from the meal of the Eucharist, this meal of thanksgiving. This truth is all through the Gospels, if we pay attention. Think of some of the safest and most cherished of our images. Think, for example, of that wonderful Good Shepherd picture from John chapter 10. But having grown up, at least partly, in Wyoming, I've never exactly forgotten why people keep sheep, and it's not for pets. I'm currently serving a vacancy in a little church that moved its old stained glass chancel window from their prior sanctuary, and it's a curious depiction of the Good Shepherd and a bunch of sheep, a bunch of lambs, actually. The odd thing is they're in town. And where I grew up, the day the sheep came to town was a special day, all right. But they weren't going to the Dairy Queen. Or think of all the other animal husbandry and agricultural images that we cherish. We are the harvest. We are that stuff that comes from God's faithful planting, God's harvesting even from the path and from the rocks on occasion. But think of what happens to the seed of God's harvest. It is grown so as to be crushed, made into food for someone else, for a starving world. It is our life to be handed over, to become sacrifice. So Mark's gospel invites its members to be baptized in a community destined for that. Perhaps they know betrayal in Nero's Rome, or some circumstance of that kind. But the more I thought about this presentation in the year since I sent my topics in, the more I began to think that our lives are not so much like Mark's readers, but more like Luke's. And so I'm going to do some Luke as well this morning, in addition to Mark. And maybe that's not so bad, seeing as how we're also coming up on lectionary year C, when we all have to think about Luke. Luke's gospel begins with Yada, with Zechariah on duty in the temple. And there he stands with his uplifted hands when the angel comes and changes everything. Luke's gospel closes with these words. Then Jesus led them out as far as Bethany, and lifting up his hands, he blessed them. And while he blessed them, he withdrew from them and was carried up into heaven, and they worshiped him and returned to Jerusalem with great joy. And they were continually in the temple, blessing God. So Luke begins with Yada and ends with Yada. Or even in the smaller units, the little birth narrative operetta with its scenes full of music, that ends with Jesus in the temple, where the blessing and the sacrificing goes on. Then we go to the wilderness in Luke's gospel, for John the Baptist and the baptism and the temptation, and from there to Nazareth and Capernaum, and in some sections a whole lot of going up and down mountains until we arrive at the great mountain, the Transfiguration. And in Luke alone, we hear the content of the conversation that happens up there on the mountain. They discuss Jesus' exodon, his exodus, or we say in the English translations, his departure, which he was about to accomplish in Jerusalem. Very shortly thereafter, in Luke 9:51, we get a very significant chronological note that most everyone sees as a dividing point in this gospel. When the days drew near for Jesus to be taken up, he set his face to go to Jerusalem. To be taken up, analemptos, is to be received as the responding gesture to this. And from this point on, then, Jesus moves insistently, if somewhat leisurely, forward towards Jerusalem. He will not be deterred until his departure is complete, his being taken up is accomplished. And I'd suggest, and I will come back to this with hopefully some symmetry to this talk toward the end, that everything from Luke 9:51 onward is Jesus being offered up and taken up. The journey is leisurely, as I say at first. There's time for all of the great parables of Luke. At 18:31, Jesus must remind the disciples of their destination. He took the 12 aside and said to them, "See, we are going up to Jerusalem, and everything that is written about the Son of Man by the prophets will be accomplished, for he will be handed over to the Gentiles, mocked, insulted, and spat upon, and so forth." But they understood nothing about all these things. In fact, what he said was hidden from them, and they did not grasp what he said. But in the next chapter, they arrive at Jerusalem. Jesus enters on a donkey. But the final steps of this journey, this departure, are most instructive. For John, this is called exaltation, death by being lifted up. Luke doesn't quite have that exact same theme, but there's something very similar here in the analempsaos, the being taken up. A verse from Luke 23. As they led Jesus away, they seized a man, Simon of Cyrene, who was coming from the country, and they laid the cross on him and made him carry it behind Jesus. Which is more or less what all the Gospels say, except Luke alone adds that little prepositional phrase, behind Jesus, so that we are invited to a slightly more detailed mental picture of this scene. Jesus walking ahead, Simon of Cyrene walking in his footsteps, carrying the cross. And there you have, of course, the image of discipleship from all the Gospels. If anyone would come after me, let that one take up his or her cross and follow me. And so now Simon of Cyrene will take up the cross and follow Jesus. Except that, as we all remember, when Luke shares that cross word about discipleship, he adds a little word there too. In Luke 9:23 and following, the crossword reads like this: "If any would come after me, let that one take up a cross daily and follow me." For in Mark's audience, when you took up a cross, it was a garden variety wooden cross, and in a half hour you would be on it, and that would be the end of that. But Luke's audience was more like us, people of some import, not chased down, headhunted for their faith. And so for them, this discipleship was a matter of daily cross-bearing. And so what we are about to witness in Luke 23 is Simon of Cyrene going to daily cross-bearing school. And let's see the lessons. All these things are totally unique to Luke. Lesson number one. A great number of people followed And among them some women who were beating their breasts and wailing for him, but Jesus turned to them and said, "Daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. For the days are surely coming when they'll say, 'Blessed are the barren and the wombs that never bore, breasts that never nursed.' People will say to the mountains, 'Fall on us,' to the hills, 'Bury us.'" An obvious reference in Luke to what happened in 70 AD, to the moment of destruction that was devastating to the Christian community as well as to the Jews who survived that far into the war. Don't weep for me. Let's not worry about that right now. Let's think about your future. Let's pay attention to your tears. Lesson two. Two others also who were criminals were led away to be put to death with him. When they came to the place that's called the Skull, they crucified Jesus there with the criminals, one on his right and one on his left. And Jesus said, "Father, forgive them. They know not what they're doing." In the midst of that experience, he pauses in concern for the executioners. Lesson three. One of the criminals who was hanged there kept deriding him, saying, "Aren't you the Messiah? Save yourself and us." The other rebuked him, saying, "Don't you fear God, since you're under the same sentence? And we justly, getting what we deserve for our deeds? This man has done nothing wrong." That one pleads to Jesus, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." And two executed guys hanging there having this conversation about their respective thrones that they seem to be on. The pleading thief hears Jesus say, "Truly I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise." So in the moment of his extremity, he makes a promise to someone else. Those are the three obvious lessons Simon learns on his day of daily cross-bearing. On your road towards crucifixion, wherever and whenever that is, look not only at your own sorrow or your own sense of betrayal or your own suffering, but look to the right and to the left. Look there for a place to focus your concern. If we've been reading Luke carefully, we've seen this pattern developing much earlier. In Luke and only Luke, Jesus, of course, has stopped to fix that ear that got lopped off back in Gethsemane at the arrest scene. In Luke's gospel, Peter denies Jesus right to his face. It seems to be in all the others that Jesus is inside somewhere and Peter outside, but it's all in the courtyard in a night of waiting for a morning trial in Luke's gospel. And the reason Luke can say that in the moment of the third denial, Jesus simply looked at Peter is because they sat there together and Peter denied Jesus to his face. And in that moment, Jesus could have been a hander over of Peter. All he had to do was smirk or chuckle. Almost any gesture save to look at Peter would have condemned the friend as well. And on, maybe perhaps we could and should add Judas' reception of the bread and the cup, for he was there as well.
the traitor to receive the handed over body and blood. In any case, now comes the end of a day of daily cross bearing, and it is a handing over. It was now about noon, and darkness came over the whole land until 3 p.m, while the sun's light failed and the curtain of the temple was torn in two. Then Jesus, crying with a loud voice, said, "Father, into your hands I commend my spirit." And having said this, he breathed his last. No cry of dereliction, as in Mark or Matthew, no cry of victory, as in John, but a different psalm, the psalm we heard last evening, the Vespers psalm, Psalm 31. What Jesus prays in Luke is verse 5 of that evening psalm, an ancient bedtime prayer. Indeed, probably one of the first, if not the first, prayer this young handed over fellow had learned from his mother. For from very ancient times in Judaism, this verse of this evening psalm was taught to children in the way that many of us learned, "Now I lay me down to sleep. I pray thee, Lord, my soul to keep." Into your hands I give my spirit. O God, thou faithful God, was the bedtime prayer taught to children in Jesus' day. And there is the secret of how he could walk that road the way he did. Because he knew at the end of his day, that's where he handed over his life, into those hands. That is the great truth of daily cross-bearing, that every day it's a handing over. And every day, no matter what happens along the way, whether we live or whether we die, it's all the same, for we hand our lives over into those hands. Those hands, of course, where we all began, as dust and breath of God. And if there is to be life, it will happen in those hands. And if there is to be death, it will happen in those same hands. That's the truth of daily cross-bearing. It is always a handing over. The disciples, of course, will again see Jesus at Emmaus at table, and again later that same night at midnight for a snack of dried fish. He comes among them, but he does not stay. Or as we say in Advent, he came, he comes, and he will come again. And that thought brings me to the way that this handing over of Christ, of Jesus, shapes our lives. In Acts chapter 1, once more we have a lifting up. So when they had come together, the disciples asked Jesus, "Lord, is this the time when you will restore the kingdom to Israel?" They're still not getting it. He replied, "It's not for you to know the times or periods that the Father has set, but you will receive power when the Holy Spirit comes. You will be my witnesses in Jerusalem and Judea and Samaria and to the ends of the earth." And when he had said this, as they were watching, he was lifted up, and a cloud took him out of their sight. And while he was going and they were gazing up toward heaven, suddenly two men in white robes stood by them, and they said, "Men of Galilee, why do you stand looking up toward heaven? This Jesus, who has been taken up from you into heaven, will come in the same way as you saw him go into heaven." What does this mean? The conventional outcome of this story, the restoration of dominion is dismissed outright. Rather, we are to expect a repeat, perhaps in reverse, of what we just witnessed. But at first glance, we might think that what we're to witness again, under the promise of these two men, is a repeat or a reversal of this levitation deal. Floating up in a cloud cover, we'll have a cloud uncover and a floating down, except the deep roots of this text back in Luke have nothing to do with the slight elevation and the cover of cloud, so much as they have to do with that analempseos. That is what the two men say you will see again. This same Jesus who was analempthes from you into heaven, received up in response to this offering. That's what you will see again. Which I take to mean that the repeat of this is not merely that Jesus will come again to relive that history, but that this is to be our history. As he came, he will come again in those who have followed, like Simon of Cyrene on the day of daily cross-bearing. So we're to go back from Acts 1 all the way to Luke 9:51, and beginning with the lifting up and the setting of our faces towards Jerusalem and being handed over to sinners, we are to find our place along the way. And ultimately, Luke sees the whole of life for those who follow Jesus as part of Jesus' coming and coming again on the way. Indeed, as you recall, that's the name of the movement for Luke, Followers of the Way. Just a couple of texts to remind us of how he talked about that. Acts 9, people asking for letters to the synagogue at Damascus so that asking if anyone found belonging to the way, men or women, they might be bound and brought to Jerusalem to be handed over, of course. But very instructive, I think, is Acts 24, just before Paul's final sojourn in Jerusalem. The governor has given Paul a hearing, Governor Felix. And Paul makes a cheerful defense. As you can find out, he says in Acts 24:11, it's not more than 12 days since I went up to worship in Jerusalem. They did not find me disputing with anyone in the temple or stirring up a crowd, either in the synagogues or throughout the city. Neither can they prove to you the charge that they now bring against me. But this I admit to you, that according to the way, which they call a sect, I worship the God of our ancestors, believing everything laid down according to the Torah or written in the prophets. So there is Paul on his last trip to Jerusalem, in the temple, worshiping as always. And he then goes to Rome, where he will be handed over. In our lives, shaped in the patterns of blessing and thanksgiving, the pattern of being handed over, Christ comes among us once more, as those two men in the white robes promised. We expect to see him come even as he was received. We walk that same road along with Simon of Cyrene and all the other daily cross-bearers here in the darkness of a world that despairs, a bunch of folks gazing up into the heavens hopelessly. We shall await and we shall witness that coming again, even as we await our own departure, our own exodon, the end of our own day of cross-bearing, and our own day of resting in those hands which received and lifted up the Lord who came and who comes and will come again. So it's really all the same thing. The betrayal and the sacrifice are one gesture. Simul traditus et sacrificatus. That's the shape of our lives. Catch. Thank you. There is treachery. I've been leading up to this with the two Judas, the first one and the Hellenized one, and we got more Judas to come, and we need, with certain kinds of betrayal, to save people from the most fearsome enemies. Well, that's a bit, I don't know if you were in the fireside room last evening, but that was kind of the question. How do you use the Bible to answer ethical questions today? How do you do biblically oriented ethics, I suppose, is the question. And I guess all I can do off the top of my head is to say what I said last night. You have to finally choose a hermeneutic. You can't, there's no simple way to just take the entire Torah and prophets and say, you know, these are the answers, and here we go. I ask a question, find a text, and say, this is it. Otherwise, we would end up in a nightmare of weird moralism and legalism. So you have to find, my opinion is anyway, that we need to find a center, you know, a hermeneutic, a place to begin, or in Dr. Hall's language, we need at least to struggle with what is the good, and put the Torah and our application of it and the prophets as well into the quest for that. Not rightness, but the good.
I'm going to follow your path anymore.
Well, I could imagine scenarios where that's what it could come to. I was struck by Bill Fagey's statement this morning that equality and freedom are enemies. You know, that's a load to think about. If we are caught in that enmity, you know, I can imagine times when we will be betrayers of things that everyone else might think was, you know, sacred and right. That's right, yeah. Just a hint, you know, one of the guys I'm going to pound on tomorrow is Jeremiah. He was not invited to a lot of parties. Yeah, but you just punched one of my hot buttons. John 13. A new commandment I give you, that you love one another as I have loved you. Well, now we're in the midst of being handed over. Because that paragraph begins with these words. When he had gone out, Jesus said, now I give you a new commandment. And the he, the antecedent of that pronoun, is Judas. Jesus has just told him to go out and do what he must do. And of course, what he must do is hand Jesus over. But of course, that's so ambiguous in John as everywhere else. And I have to believe that the reason why you need a new commandment is because now there's a traitor out there. And we had better learn to love, not any longer in the old way. The old way is love your neighbor as yourself. But now when there's traitors out there, and we should all be asking, is it I? When you got to be asking, is it I? You need to love more than you can love yourself, or differently, or some other way. You need to love in the way that Christ loves, which is even to love the traitor. Well, I would think I'll let Dr. Hall answer. No. Yeah, we... Well, I'll just give you a thought process. I don't have a good answer to this. If I can, I'll try to summarize. The eighth commandment, large catechism, is that what you're looking at? Suggests that there are three people who have, unlike the rest of the population, people in three roles have the right to call folks to account for their behavior: the magistrate, the pastor, and the parent. The first thought that came to my mind was the fourth commandment: you honor your parents. And we it's used there to honor, and I suppose what we're doing is we're also extending this role somehow or another to the pastor, the shepherd. To honor in the biblical language, that verb to honor means to treat as heavy. Kaved is to honor. Kavod is God's glory, which is a word for weight, God's heaviness. So to honor someone is to accord them with heaviness, to treat them as heavy. But heavy with what? I think that in the best circumstance, you honored the emperor because you assumed the emperor really cared about every citizen, like a parent who loved the child. And the reason you honor parents is because you assume that somewhere beneath all their foibles and failings, and their ignorance and everything else that they might share along with you, they are heavy, heavy with love for you. That's where honor starts. And so I guess I would say the Eighth Commandment explanation in the Large Catechism must be grounded somewhere in the notion that those are the three people that you can count on loving you. Now, whether that's still true is another question. The courts in my town, I don't know. But there's no lawyers here to defend. Or maybe there are. Yeah, the tradition, as I've been reading it, calls us to be subversives in a society that wants to have a front of something else. And, I don't just intend to sound like some refugee from the 60s or something, but, you know, when the church doesn't understand itself as just somewhat subversive of the values, the free market, you know, we have lost our anchor, or our moorings, or our compass, or something.
Well, yeah, I didn't really want to come and make some sort of assault on the so-called church growth movement. You know, I'm not a parish pastor, so I don't face those kinds of pressures. But it does seem to me that there is always the temptation to the church in every age. You know, this is nothing new, that we are tempted to go with the free market, whatever the free market used to be called. My opinion is actually that the original name for the free market is the golden calf. You know, they didn't know where Moses was anymore. Where is this man Moses who brought us up from the land of Egypt? And Moses, of course, was the guy who was taught to say the answer to the question, "Who is the God who sent you?" "I am." Moses spoke for God. And he's gone, you know, and they don't know what, they want to keep on the journey. They don't know exactly where to go, so they make a golden calf. And when finally called to account for how they got that thing, Aaron says, "You know, I don't know, Moses. I got a bunch of gold and I threw it in a fire and this calf jumped out." You know, it's a kind of a thing that you make to lead you to the promised land and then you forget you made it. And you think it just sprang up. And it's going to take us to the promised land, which is a big lie. You know? So, where am I going? You know, that's the way the free market looks to me. It looks like something we constructed. And then we say, "God, I don't know where this came from. You know, it's got a life of its own. You know, we better follow it." I think it's dangerous. I don't want to go. That doesn't lead into this.